Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about a project I've been working on called COMET, which stands for Code Offload by Migrating Execution Transparently. It's joint work with myself, Nushe Jamshidi, Scott Malky, Morley Mao, and Xu Chen. So I'm going to start out by introducing the problem of offloading, which is what we're trying to solve with COMET. Then I'm going to talk about distributed shared memory, which will be an enabling mechanism for the rest of the design of COMET. Then I'll get into the evaluation of COMET, and then we'll close with a summary and then questions. So the question is, what is offloading? Offloading is this idea that we have all these mobile devices these days, and they have limited resources, whether those resources be computation, energy, memory. But despite this, they're typically well connected to the network. So maybe we can somehow add the resources that are available in the network to the mobile computation and improve the experience from the mobile computation. And in particular, we're going to be interested in if we can do this kind of thing transparently, so we can bring this these additional resources transparently to existing applications for mobile. So there's been a few past work that have done this. In particular, more recently, Maui and CloneCloud have attempted to solve this problem. And these systems have helped to bring computation, energy, and memory, as I said, from the network to the mobile environment. And they do this through a capture and migrate paradigm. So they'll have some subsystem that helps identify which methods should be sent to a remote server to be executed. And then they'll capture all the state that could be used by that method, and then actually move the computation over to the remote server. The main drawback of this approach that we see is that it won't work well with multi-threaded environments. And it won't work well with synchronization primitives. And we see that the idea of offloading entire methods is kind of too coarse of granularity. So this won't work well when you have work loops, where only maybe part of the loop will need to be offloaded. So our four goals for COMET that we get from related work that we want to improve is, first, we're going to focus on improving the computation speed on mobile devices. We could easily swap this for any of the other resources that are available on the network, but we'll focus on computation speed. Our second goal is that we want to require no programmer effort. So you can imagine that there's this whole continuum of how much programmer effort you could require, all the way from having the programmer essentially implement all of the offloading logic manually to what we're trying to get at with COMET, where almost everything's taken care of for the programmer. So I like to make the analogy that this is like a compiler. So you can write all your native applications directly in machine code or assembly. Or you can write it in C and have the compiler convert it to machine code for you. So we want COMET to kind of take a similar role, where it'll take away a lot of the grunt work, and it might be able to do a better job than the developer would be able to do manually. The third goal is kind of in line with the previous goal, that we want to generalize well with existing applications. And in particular, we want to work with multi-threaded applications, and we want to work well with synchronized primitives. And our fourth goal is we want to be resistant to network failures. So when you're working in a mobile environment, you're communicating wirelessly. So if you move too far away from your wireless router, you'll lose network connectivity. Or if you move out of coverage, radio coverage, you'll lose connectivity. And we don't want our applications to just fail if you were in the middle of offloading. So these kind of build the whole goals of COMET. Below that, you can see our from 10,000 feet view of the design of COMET. We modified the Dalvik virtual machine on the Android operating system. So we're working in a Java runtime environment. So on the left, we have the phone operating system, which will be running the unmodified mobile application. And we're going to have some of the execution happening on the remote server in parallel, and we'll keep the states between these two blocks in synchronized. All right, so now I'm going to move into a bit of distributed shared memory. So at a high level, we can view COMET as bridging, merging the motivation of offloading, where we want to bridge the computation disparity that exists between these server class machines and these mobile phones, with the mechanism of distributed shared memory, which is going to help us create a logically shared address space, which is going to make help facilitate offloading. But the main problem when we're trying to apply distributed shared memory is that it's usually applied to cluster environments where you have where you typically have a low latency and high throughput, and you might be working with several different machines. But with our environment, with our use case, we'll have, because we're communicating wirelessly, we'll have a much higher latency, a much lower throughput, and we typically only need to work with one additional machine. So this puts a few more extra requirements on how our distributed shared memory should work, and also lets us have some more leeway in the fact that we only need to work with one extra machine. But the reason that we can't apply traditional distributed shared memory techniques is that you have to wait too many round-trip times, usually. So this is a demonstration of how conventional distributed shared memory would work from the Munin paper. So in this case, the bottom left-hand machine is going to attempt to write to the variable x. And when it does that, it'll update its local cache of the variable x. And then it needs to invalidate the local cache on the other machines before it can continue executing. And before it can continue, it needs to hear back that the cache has been successfully invalidated. So we have to essentially wait a whole round trip time just to write to one variable. And then if we wanted to do a read on, say, the top machine, it would need to go ask the owner of the memory for the current value of the memory, which would take another round trip time. So to understand what we can do with Comet, we need to understand the underlying memory model of our system. So as I said, we're modifying the Dalvik virtual machine, which runs on the Java runtime. So we need to understand the Java memory model to understand what executions of an application are acceptable. So the Java memory model is going to dictate which writes each read can observe during the execution of your program. And it does this by specifying a happens before partial ordering between all of the memory accesses in your application. So the way that this works briefly is that all the accesses that happen in a single thread are totally ordered by the way that they were executed in that thread, the way that the programmer wrote it. And then across threads, lazy release consistency is used. And what this means, more or less, is that if I acquire and release a lock, and then you later acquire and release that lock, all my memory accesses that happen before my release of the lock are said to happen before your memory accesses that happen after the acquire of the lock. Said in maybe a more intuitive way, all my memory accesses that happen before I release the lock should be made visible to all your memory accesses after you later acquired that same lock. Another interesting aspect of the Java memory model is that it's defined entirely in terms of fields. And in particular, they have a known alignment and a known width. And because of that, we can have distributed shared memory schemes where both endpoints can write to the same field, and we can still merge in a coherent way without creating values out of thin air, another thing that is not allowed by the Java memory model. So with that in mind, we can create a simple field-based distributed shared memory scheme. I don't know why that's up there. Okay. So we can just track dirty fields locally. So every time we write to a field, we'll just mark it as dirty. And then every time we need to establish a happens before partial ordering between two endpoints, we'll just transfer the dirty fields from the endpoint, from one endpoint to the other, and then mark those fields dirty locally, or clean locally. The reason that this kind of distributed shared memory technique hasn't been used in past distributed shared memory systems is that it's not clear how well it scales past two endpoints. But for our use case, that doesn't seem to matter. And if you did want to work with multiple endpoints, you could just use classic distributed shared memory techniques on the server side to emulate essentially a server with more cores. All right, now I'm going to get into the actual key element of the design of Comet, and that is the VM synchronization. So we use the VM synchronization to establish a happens before relationship between endpoints. So it's going to be a directed operation between what we'll call the pusher and what we'll call the pooler. And it's responsible, in addition to synchronizing the Java heap, as we mentioned before, it'll be responsible for synchronizing the Java bytecode sources and the Java thread stacks. So the first step that happens in a VM synchronization is we need to synchronize the Java bytecode sources. So this operation is going to begin by sending any new code that's been loaded since the last time we did a VM synchronization. So this usually happens just once when the application starts, and most applications in the Android on Android only have one bytecode source. So the pusher is going to say, I loaded a new bytecode source, and the puller will either load this from its cache, or if it doesn't have it in its cache, it'll ask for the entire bytecode source and then save it to its cache and load it into memory. The second step that's going to happen is we need to send over some of the thread stacks. So the way that a thread stack looks is just a series of method frames. In each method frame, you'll have a method identifier, a program counter within that method, and then any registers that are being used by that method at that program counter. Fortunately, using data structures that already existed in the Dalvik virtual machine, we can figure out which registers correspond to objects at any point in the method's execution so that we can properly serialize this when we're talking to the pooler. And then the last step, as we said before, is that we need to send over any changed or new fields. And we'll only send over these changed fields to a shared heap. And the shared heap is going to include all the globally reachable objects and any objects that are reachable from the thread stacks that we sent over in the previous step. Okay. And this heap update is just going to look like a series of fields and then new values for those fields. So with the heap update under our belt, we can talk about how lock ownership should work. We're going to annotate each lock with a lock ownership flag. So the way this will work is that each endpoint only one of the endpoints will have ownership of a lock at any given time. And if we want to acquire a lock locally, if we already own the lock, we can just acquire as normal. Otherwise, if the other endpoint owns the lock, we'll need to request for ownership from that endpoint. That endpoint will then normally respond with a VM synchronization to establish the necessary happens before relationship that the Java memory model requires. And then it'll actually transfer the ownership of the lock, and then the acquire can proceed as normal. We can then do thread migration pretty simply. We just do a VM synchronization, and we make sure that we send over the thread stack that we're interested in migrating. And now that we sent over the thread stack, it'll have all the necessary information that the pooler can just simply continue executing that thread locally, and the pusher can just stop executing the thread. In addition to just moving who's doing the execution, we also need to move the ownership of any held locks that the thread we're migrating has. Okay. So at this point, you might wonder why don't we just migrate all the threads at the beginning of their creation and then just let them run on the server until they're done executing? The main reason that we can't do this is because of native methods. So these are methods that are written in C and with bindings to be accessed within Java. And they exist for three primary reasons. The first reason is to access resources that access device resources like the file system or the display. OS file system.write is one example of this. The second reason is for performance reasons, but this is kind of going out of style with the introduction of the JIT to the Dalvik virtual machine. And the third reason is to work with existing libraries. So you might have a library that was written in C or some other language that you want to access. And so our default behavior is that it's not generally going to be safe to run these kinds of native methods on the server endpoints, because there might be some secret hidden state, or we might not even have a version of the native code to run on the server in the server's architecture. So fortunately, most applications don't even include their own native code. So what we can do is we can manually go through all the native code that exists in the Android stack and manually whitelist those that are safe to run on the server, or try to convert the ones that aren't safe to pure Java. Okay, so now we can actually talk about how failure recovery works. So we've designed our VM synchronization to be recovery safe, and we do that by always leaving enough information on the client so that if we never hear again from the server, we can resume all the threads execution on the client, and it'll be fine. So this is the primary, one of the reasons that we want to send over the, so whenever we do a VM synchronization from the server, we need to send over all the thread stacks that are running locally on the server. And to see why, we can take this example where we'll migrate thread one to the server. Thread one will run on the server. It'll increment the value of X. And then some other action that's happening during the application's execution will cause a VM synchronization, and it'll send the update of X to the client. But if we don't send over the stack thread and we lose a connection, now the stack is in an inconsistent state. And if we let the thread continue to execute on the client, we'll increment X again, which is not correct behavior. Instead, what we're supposed to do is when we do the VM synchronization from the server, we also send over the updated thread stack. So now that the thread stack starts at bar where the server was during the VM synchronization. So the thread stack and the heap are in a consistent state. So now when we lose connection to the server, we can continue executing thread one. OK, so the final task is the scheduling. How do we decide what to run on the server and what to run locally? We have a pretty simple scheduler at the moment. We model the execution of all the threads as containing a few of these red boxes, which are meant to represent native methods that can only run on the client. So we have some parameter tau, which we'll get to how we set tau later. And every time a thread executes without hitting one of these red boxes for time tau, it can be migrated to the server and run on the server until it hits another one of these red boxes when it has to go back. So in order to make some guarantees about what can happen, okay. So in the first case, we migrate, and then we immediately have to migrate back because we migrated right before a red box. And that's basically the worst case that Comet can have. In the second case, there's a lot more execution after the migrate, so we get some net gains. So we set tau by setting it to be approximately the amount of time that it takes to migrate a thread and then have it migrate back. So that in the worst case, when we have to migrate back immediately after our initial migrates, we'll only half the throughput. OK, so now I'll talk a little bit about the implementation of Comet. So we built Comet on top of the CEngine mod, Gingerbread branch. The actual current version is now based off of Jelly Bean, which is the current version of Android out. It's about 5,000 lines of code. And in our prototype, we did not include the just-in-time compiler. And the reasons for this are it would, at the time that we were working on this, there was no just-in-time compiler available for the x86 architecture. And it's still not completely pulled into the CEngine mod source. So that would make an unfair comparison. And also, it would require a lot more developer time on our end to actually integrate with the JIT completely. All right, so now I'll talk a little bit about the evaluation of Comet. So we evaluated Comet on a 1 gigahertz Samsung Captivate phone and a 8-core server running a Xeon processor. We hand-selected 8 applications that existed on Google Play. We did have to hand-select them, but this is at least a step above the previous work, which wrote their own applications and then benchmark off of that. So these are applications that we did not write. And we were able to get, over Wi-Fi, a 2.9x speedup. And over 3G, we were able to get about a 1.3x speedup. We found that over 3G, most applications couldn't benefit from offloading. And this is partially, this might improve a bit with LTE, or it might improve if you went to somewhere with good 3G coverage. We were also able to, as a consequence of improving computation speed, we were able to improve energy savings. So for Wi-Fi, we were able to save 1.5x energy. And on 3G, we actually had a net loss of energy by keeping the 3G radio resource active and not getting much performance gain. But our main focus, again, was improving computation. We also looked at two computation benchmarks. So the first benchmark was also available on Google Play. That's the Linpack benchmark. And we were able to get about a 10x speedup on Linpack using Wi-Fi. And then we also handwrote an application to do factoring, and it used multiple threads on our 8-core server. And it was able to get a 200x speedup, that should say 200x. And that's because we were able to use all 8 cores that were available on our server. And the last thing that we looked at was we thought it would be interesting if we could offload web applications. But unfortunately, all the browsers that we could find available for Android were written mostly in C. So we were able to find a JavaScript interpreter called Rhino that was written in Java, pure Java. And we evaluated comets on the JavaScript, or the SunSpider JavaScript benchmark. And we were able to get about a 6x speedup on average for all the benchmarks that existed. And this is kind of cool because it would suggest that if we had a browser that was written in Java and we had web applications that did a lot of computation, we might be able to actually offload web applications. So we might be able to work with a derived runtime. All right. So to summarize, Comet tried to merge the motivation of offloading with the mechanism of distributed shared memory. We were able to improve the computation speed of our applications. We didn't require any programmer efforts. We think that it generalized pretty well with our runtime and is able to actually resist network failures. We think that our major computations is a design and implementation that achieves these four goals. And in particular, we had fine granularity offloading support, so you could offload in the middle of a method as opposed to offloading entire methods with patchwork. And we had complete multi-threading support, so you could offload multiple threads at the same time. And we also had this field-based distributed shared memory coherency protocol, which we believe is new. So the source is now available. You can follow that link, or you can search for my name in Comet. Does anyone have any questions?
Evgeny Vinnik, Simon Fraser University. Most of the applications for Android require user input, like, I don't know, games and so on. How they will benefit from code offloading? I mean, and having network overlays on.
So certain types of applications, certainly we're not going to be able to benefit from offloading. So applications that have a lot of user interaction are probably not going to be able to benefit from offloading. The applications that we had in our benchmark included things like a chess app, a fractal renderer, an image filter, things that have some kind of kernel of computation that might be suitable for offloading.
Thank you.
Yang Tang from Columbia University. This work reminds me of Intel's Clone Cloud system. So could you please briefly introduce the differences between this work and Clone Cloud?
Right. So the main difference between this work and Clone Cloud is that we can support offloading multiple threads. We have complete support for that. So with Clone Cloud, they did have some support for offloading the thread and still letting things execute locally. But sometimes they would have to block if they needed state that was needed remotely. But with our system, that's never the case. Additionally, we're able to offload in the middle of a method, so we can work well with method or work loops. So you might have a work loop that just pulls tasks that might require a lot of computation. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to decide up front if you want to offload that whole thing without knowing what kind of work you'll need to be doing. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Saurabh Bakhchi from Purdue University. So you mentioned that you had handpicked the applications for offloading. Could you speculate on the ability to automatically find out if an application relies on frequent user interactions and therefore would not be suitable for offloading, or maybe it requires some inputs from the environment in which it is, in which the phone is, so it would not be suitable for offloading.
So we're considering doing a user study where we basically plot the create those diagrams where I had the thread and the red boxes and figure out basically what is the amount of time between things that need to run on the clients, and we can try to tell from that if it'll be if we'll be able to benefit from offloading. Is that?
So Jit Upadhyay from MSR. I was actually going to ask the same question that Saurabh asked, so I'll just rephrase that question a little bit. If tomorrow somebody wanted to deploy an infrastructure like this commercially, what kind of applications would benefit from it the most? And why would an app writer want to enroll his app in this scheme? Or why would the phone, what are the main benefits? And in what kind of apps would benefit from this?
So yeah, like I said, the kind of applications that are going to benefit are the kind of applications that have some kind of kernel of kernel of computation that you're going to be able to move between the endpoints. So things like turn-based games will be able to benefit. Things that just generally need a lot of computation, and it might open up a new class of applications that can be used.
Hi, Arjun Roy from UC San Diego. I have a couple of related questions, kind of. First is, what happens when you have to do I/O? So if you have something that's running on the desktop and it needs to like touch the disk on the phone. And a related question in terms of other potential applications for this. Can you see something like this working kind of like in a data center when you want to move something like the computation closer to the data that it has to operate on? And finally, what would it take to get native code kind of working with this sort of model? And I guess all three of these questions kind of dovetail together as well with the whole data center usage.
OK, so the first question, the answer is if we hit a, when you do some kind of like a disk read, it's going to translate into a native function, which is going to force us to migrate back to the client. You could try to virtualize the file system, which is something that Clone Cloud did. But we didn't attempt to do that in this work, so that the file system is, there's some kind of file system that's available between the server and the client that can be accessed. I don't remember what your third question was.
I guess the third question was, what would it take for native code to be, would you need to like restrict the kinds of stuff that you do with native code, or what would it take for getting migration of just like native C code across systems like this?
It's definitely it's a tricky problem because there can be hidden native state, and it's difficult to tell where that state could be hidden. If you have the developer somehow expose that to the comments, we might be able to do it. Otherwise, if there's a few native methods that you just want to work, then you could just manually make it work with comment.
All right. Thanks.
Alec Wallman, Microsoft. I was just wondering, you mentioned in the paper that you analyzed a couple hundred native methods that you determined were actually safe for offload. And I was wondering, what's the criteria that you use when a program actually calls a native method to decide whether or not it's safe?
So the main criteria is that, one, it's not making any system calls to access resources that are available only on the client. If we want failure recovery, we actually need a little bit stronger requirements because we don't want a native frame to exist on the server when we do a VM synchronization. So we don't want it to be calling back into the VM in the middle of its execution if we want to be able to run it on the server. So like a native method that updates a field, we couldn't actually offload it.
Thanks.
Okay.